ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you could have a conversation with any writer, living or dead, who would you pick? Is there a novelist that you'd want to have round to your place to talk over the big questions of life and meaning? I'm Meredith Lake, and in this episode of Soul Search, a New Year book binge, if you will, as part of our summer series here on ABC Radio National. Now, last year, you and I actually spent quite a bit of time thinking about books together. I wanted to know how different literatures might accompany us as we explore sacredness and reality. Across 2025, this bookish quest became, I think, a six-part occasional series. You can find the whole lot of them on the Soul Search website if you want to have a listen. Just type big questions in books, Soul Search, into your search engine. But this one, well, this was one of my favourite conversations, and in fact, where it all began, with a question about literature and love, with a few Russian novelists thrown in. Michael McGirr is an avid reader, for many years a teacher and critic of literature. He's currently mission director with Caritas Australia, but he's also the author of Books That Saved My Life. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Meredith. How are you today?
I'm very well. Who would you have for dinner? If you could pick a writer, living or dead, to turn up at your place and kind of chew the fat, literally and metaphorically, who would you choose?
Every year, without fail, I read a book by Charles Dickens. And at the moment, I'm two-thirds of the way through Our Mutual Friend, which is from late in his life, and it's a bit darker than some of his other books. It's also a bit more explicitly religious than some of his other books, and I would love to discuss it with him.
Wow. You've never had dinner with him, I'm assuming.
He died in 1870, by which stage I was only about 10 years old.
Oh, yes, but I know you've got a good imagination. And have you ever kind of workshopped, at least for your own pleasure, the conversation that you'd have with him?
Not in detail, although the first question I would say, I'd bring some of my favourite moments and passages and say, how did you do that? How did you make somebody so comic, also so poignant and so heartbreaking and so hilarious all at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great pleasure, wouldn't it, to ask Charles Dickens that question?
But I think his secret is I don't think he knew quite how he did it. And if he did know, he would have stopped doing it, perhaps, because there is a beautiful unself-consciousness. You know, he wrote at great speed, and mm-hmm. I think it just fell out of him. And how it got into his head, well, there's a real X factor there, a real mystery factor.
Mm. Yeah, a kind of inspiration maybe that's difficult to account for.
Yeah, and in fact, I got the impression that in life he was a fairly uninteresting conversationalist, you know. I think that's the other thing too. I think he was somebody who could sit at that desk for hours on end, and he could cope with the isolation, cope with the solitude, cope with the scariness of the blank page.
So, I mean, obviously Dickens, you know, someone you return to every year, as you said, Michael, but more generally, why do you read? And I'm asking you, knowing that you read a lot of books, why is reading and reading fiction especially something that, you know, it'd be difficult to not do in your life?
It feeds me, Meredith. It's like, it's just, to me, it's just like eating. You know, it feeds my imagination, it feeds my heart, especially fiction. It saddens me that people don't have time to read fiction or get impatient with it, because it does require a little bit of putting the here and now aside. And also, we all suffer, all of us, from shortening attention spans. People have reported on that a lot. And to sit down with a book, an unplugged book, and be present to it, well, that's a bit countercultural now, which worries me.
Mm.
I mean, but I would be, my imagination would be starved without the great encounters I've had in fiction.
It's interesting that in some ways, if we can sit there long enough, a lot of us read to escape the hurried, busy world that, you know, crowds in upon us all. And there's a paradox, I think, with that, because we know these worlds are made up. You know, that Dickens, wherever he got his inspiration, put that person on the page. They're not exactly real. So why is it that fiction and what we know is invented somehow can, I guess, feed our imaginations in a really, in a way that lands in our lives, you know?
That's how it all started for me, Meredith. I remember when I was in year seven in, this will date me, 1974, and we'd just taken delivery of our first colour TV, and my father was very sick. He had renal failure. So it was a very sad day. We came home, and a total coincidence, the first episode of the BBC production of War and Peace, starring a very young Anthony Hopkins, was coming on. And I fell into it. And it starts with the most escapist scene you could imagine of Natasha Rostov's name day. And here's a huge banquet taking place with lots of crockery and cutlery and the whole bit. And so I got the book and I started reading the book in sync with the series. And people sometimes say, oh, you're seven, you are reading War and Peace. War and Peace is the greatest work of pulp fiction ever written. You know, it is a page turner.
It is. If you can get into the dinner party and figure out all the names and the characters and what on earth is going on, then,
but you know, over a period of time, it took me out the other end. So I went in through a door marked escapism and I came out a door marked at home in reality. And that exit door came about through, there's a character called Pierre Bezukhov, who is one of the, that was Hopkins actually in this series, but one of
I got to watch this, Michael, I got to watch it.
One of the great characters in all fiction, and he's a person, he's very wealthy, but doesn't know where he belongs, he's disowned, he's the illegitimate son of his father, he gets into a loveless marriage which falls apart, he doesn't belong in there, doesn't belong anywhere, he's very socially awkward. He tries everything. He tries Freemasonry. He tries all sorts of things looking for a place to belong in the world. And eventually the invaders get to Moscow.
This is Napoleon and his mob.
Yes. And Napoleon is an interesting figure in War and Peace. But Pierre's wandering around his mansions and he's got nothing better to do than to join the queue of refugees, and he gets taken out and he ends up amongst the refugees, unable to cope because he's so hopeless, he's an aristocrat, but he falls in with a guy called Platon Karatayev, who is a peasant. And Platon looks after him and helps him survive. And he's a person that Pierre would not have, you know, had anything to do with. He's a, you know, just the lowest of the low. But Platon has a big heart. Anyway, to cut a long story short,
it is a long story.
Well, this book is 1,500 pages, let's not forget.
Months of your life.
But the column of refugees has to move on, and Platon keeps Pierre going and going. But eventually Platon can no longer walk himself. And so the soldiers take Platon to the side of the line and shoot him in cold blood. And Pierre does not even look back. And this was a moment for me. And also that's the turning point for Pierre, because he realizes not how good he is, but how bad he is and how broken and imperfect. And this was a moment for me where I thought, gosh, this book is actually creating a life that I want to live. And it's modeling something. And this is 19th century Russia in the snow.
That you're reading at 13. Wow.
Yeah, and I was reading it in a humid Sydney summer, you know, but the storytelling was so powerful. I have, look, this is now, what, 40 years later, 50 years later. I'm telling you about this moment I had reading. And all the time I taught, I wanted kids to experience that. And they did often. I really wanted kids to experience that. And, you know, Meredith, I read some educational research which said that there are two main ways that kids develop their compassion. For a kid to not develop, but actually to discover their compassion. One is through service of people, say old people or homeless people, service and encounter with people close to the bottom. That's important. And the other important thing is reading fiction or encountering difficult, complex narratives. So not just reading fiction, but looking at complex movies and all that sort of thing. But anything that helps you understand that life ain't so simple.
Mm.
And that's for me what literature and teaching has been about, especially these days. Everybody wants to hide behind a slogan. We're seeing the triumph of single message politics, you know, sloganeering and stuff, and you know,
yeah. But just the world is. The world is complex. There's no shortage of deeply complex people and contexts at the end of our own fingertips, right?
But sadly,
but what is it about fiction that means we go there?
Sadly, the world is immensely complex. Sadly, Meredith, the path to power in the world these days is by pretending it is not. And that pretending that there are some people who understand what I understand and the others don't, and the ones who don't, they're not on my team, and therefore I am against them. That is the tragedy of the world. What does fiction offer as an alternative?
Yeah.
Well, I could give you stacks of examples.
I'm sure.
Take the example of To Kill a Mockingbird, which everybody has read, and a book that could have become divided between black and white, and there's a character in it called Blanche DuBois, who is a drug addict, who is as confounding to, she's very respectable, but she's a drug addict. And the kids go into her house and see how soiled and dirty her bed linen is, and that is the immense nuance of that book and any other book worth, you know, really worth bothering with.
On Soul Search, you're hearing from Michael McGirr. For a long time, he was an educator. He's a very widely published reviewer, and he's also the author of several books, including one about the wisdom and the solace and the pleasure that he finds in reading. I mean, You've written about, I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird, War and Peace, several dozen other books that have stayed with you for a long time, Michael. And the title of your book about reading was Books That Saved My Life.
Mm.
I mean, salvation, if we want to talk in those terms, I mean, it's a very strong word.
It is.
And I know you wouldn't use it lightly as someone with a formal religious education and vocation in many ways. How do you relate your reading of fiction to your own life of faith?
Oh, that is a lovely, lovely question. I'd start with how I read scripture. I start every day of my life with the words of one of the Psalms, you know, O God, you are my God, for you I long, for you I long. Now, where does that longing take me?
Mm.
That longing takes me, I hope, to a radical openness to the story of others. I was up in the park walking the dog just yesterday, and a woman, she's a nurse, she was walking her dog, and she was telling me she's worked for 27 years at a major public hospital in trauma.
Mm.
And she was starting to tell me what this was like for her. And, well, there was something in me that just wanted to know. Now, that is, I think that comes to some extent from a habit of loving stories, but also from this daily prayer. You know, for you I long. You, my soul is thirsting. And here is something on my parched soul, this stranger I met. I think scripture fires the imagination. Scripture, I don't think, is primarily about a series of beliefs or doctrines. I know that people got to that place and got to creedal formula and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But reading scripture, you have to let it work on your imagination and not over-intellectualize all the contradictions and apparent contradictions and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
So that word saves.
Yeah.
What is salvation?
And does it matter if you're reading the Bible or a novel? I mean, yes, but how?
Well, I think that the Bible, scripture is in a class of its own, although there are novellas within the Bible, like the book of Jonah is a novella.
The book of Ruth.
Yes. But other parts of it have, like, there's all sorts of different ways of writing about sacred experience which enter into the Bible. That word salvation, it starts, for me, it's a big word, you're right, but the key to the door, the first door, is an escape from the tyranny of my own ego by putting me in touch with the humanum, the human family, creation, that none of this is about me or even principally about me. You know that I'm here for a short space of time. I hope it'll be, you know, a good few years yet, but, you know, a long life is short, Meredith. And what is beyond that? And what is that part of? That is where I just, I don't have the answer. And if I did have the answer, I wouldn't need to read novels. That's what I reckon.
Mm. Are you saying really that you go to novels with that question of, well, the ultimate question, what am I here for and what happens next?
I do. And it really, really annoys me when novels shy away from it and get stuck in ideology and narrow agenda and are written sort of formulaically. But sometimes even in pulp fiction.
Like War and Peace, you mean?
But sometimes even in pulp fiction, you come across something that is very thought-provoking.
I want to come back to Tolstoy, who, I mean, you did semi-facetiously describe War and Peace as a work of pulp fiction earlier, Michael. And that idea of escaping from the tyranny of our own egos, as you put it. Because Tolstoy is such an interesting example of that, because in some ways it's obvious, isn't it, when his characters kind of reach some kind of clarity.
Yeah, it is.
It's kind of a preachiness or a transparency around that, shall we say. And at the same time, he, you know, the struggle to escape our own egos plays out in his own life, not just on the page of his books.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was an egomaniac. When you asked earlier, who would you like to have dinner with? I didn't say Tolstoy because I think he would have been very heavy weather, you know. And he also was not good to his wife, Sonia, who was 20 years younger than him. And Sonia, you know, did so much of the work that his reputation relies on. He was also, I think, socially quite inept. But nonetheless, it's interesting you use the word preachiness to describe Tolstoy. And that, I think, whilst he's a great novelist, that is true. Some people have compared Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, both of whom were extraordinarily, they were just religiously fascinated, both of them. And one person, I was trying to find out who it was, but I think it might have been George Steiner, but somebody said that the Christ of Tolstoy is the Christ of the Beatitudes, and the Christ of Dostoevsky is the Christ of Calvary and the cross. And that is a profound understanding of them both, because Tolstoy, he loved the teaching of Christ. He actually produced his own Bible, which was just the teaching of Christ, and left out all the miracles and all the other things like that. And that's part of the reason why he got on so badly with the religious authorities of Russia of his time. Mm. Whereas Dostoevsky was absolutely enthralled by the suffering of God and the suffering of God among us. Dostoevsky was imprisoned in the gulag for years for trumped up political reasons, and he was a gambler, and he was an epileptic. He had everything that, you know. And Dostoevsky had the experience of being put up before a firing squad, and just before he was shot, they let him off. And this story is put into The Idiot, and it's told through the eyes of the prince, who is the idiot in The Idiot, who is about to be shot, but ends up getting off. And just as they raise the guns, he's looking at the human beings, and he looks over their head and sees sunlight hitting the steeple of the church in the distance. And he has this sort of epiphany where he realizes that this life and next life, it's all just part of eternity. And he's telling this story at a fashionable dinner party. And of course, all the fashionable guests just say, "Oh, what tosh, poo-poo, you know, I bet he..." But no, it's quite a profound moment for the prince.
There are, I think for many of us, reading has become, especially reading novels, has become a space where we ask our biggest questions about the world that we live in and who we might be and whether there could be such a thing as meaning in it all, right?
Mm, yes.
And yet you're someone who also finds that fire for the imagination in sacred texts. And it sounds to me like at the same time reading fiction has been important for your faith.
Oh, very much so. And I'm a Catholic, and I find reading fiction is quite Eucharistic. What does that mean?
Yeah, that you're going to have to tell me.
Well, the Eucharist is another name for Mass, but it's sort of the place at which we take the bread and wine, we take the basic stuff of life and realize that this is the presence of God among us, right? And that's what I find in fiction. It takes the basic stuff of life, and in the best of it, I have an overwhelming sense of the sacred, that these lives are about far more than themselves.
Hmm. Something Eucharistic about fiction. I'm going to have to go away and think about that, Michael.
Well, by that I mean, and I don't hold myself up to be a great authority, but I mean just taking the basic stuff of life, sort of giving it over, saying this is what we got, bread and wine or whatever else, you just give it over. And then there's this reassurance that, yep, this too can be made sacred.
Michael McGirr, Seeing the Sacred in Literature. He's currently Director of Mission at Caritas Australia. He's also the author of Books That Saved My Life, Reading for Wisdom, Solace and Pleasure. I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search on ABC Radio National this summer, sharing some of my favourite conversations from the year that's been. It's interesting, isn't it, how reading and reading fiction can bring questions of meaning right to the surface. I wonder if there's a novel that's mattered a lot to you, that's been a companion or a conversation partner in the face of life's biggest questions. Well, come with me now to Glasgow's West End, to the front door of a second-story tenement.
Late Victorian apartment, not entirely unlike the kind of apartments Dostoevsky would have known in St. Petersburg.
It's late, but the light's still on. The guy who lives here must still be awake.
A middle-aged academic who's having something of a midlife crisis.
There he is, in the lounge room.
He's sitting up late drinking a glass of whiskey, reading a short story by Dostoevsky that ends with something like a howl of despair, the feeling that basically the universe couldn't care less, that the universe has no interest in human beings, it's completely indifferent to us, that we come and we go, and that's it, that there's no point in it at all.
I was going to ask him which writer, living or dead, this academic would like to have dinner with, but it looks like I've caught him in a moment of nihilist dread.
He's thinking about this when suddenly...
there, in the other chair, a man with a beard.
There is Dostoevsky sitting opposite him, the other side of the fireplace.
Dostoevsky? Here? That's a bit weird. But I guess the academic's going to get his chance to actually ask all his questions about the stories themselves and about that existential dread he's carrying. It's a thought experiment, of course, but George Patterson sustains it. He's a philosopher and a former professor of divinity at Oxford and Glasgow universities. He's written a whole book of imagined conversations with Dostoevsky.
Well, Dostoevsky's been speaking to every generation since his own in different ways, of course. And I think in the case of Dostoevsky, Dostoevsky is someone who puts across very different points of views in his novel, to the point that people sometimes say you can't really work out what Dostoevsky himself thinks. Unlike Tolstoy, who preaches at the reader and tells you what to think and makes sure that you know who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. But yeah. Dostoevsky leaves things up in the air and you have to work it out.
Hmm. It's interesting that, in a way, all fiction gives us some scope at least to extend our sympathies or to try on another perspective, at least for the duration of the book. But do you think turning to Dostoevsky in particular to process our big questions is, you know, is it something about him that stands out for you? How much of this thought experiment, so to speak, relies on who Dostoevsky is and the kind of things that he wrote?
I think it's also a historical affinity, if you like, that Dostoevsky lived at a time when Russia was undergoing a very rapid modernization and industrialization, with all the consequences of that in terms of mass poverty, in terms of people losing a sense of who they are, losing traditional values, family breakdown, all the things that some of the newspapers complain of today. And that in many ways, he is our contemporary. And that's partly, I think, why I set it in Glasgow, not just because I did used to live in a second floor apartment in Glasgow, but also because I think that there's something about the history of Glasgow that mirrors, if you like, the history of Russia in Dostoevsky's time, a place that particularly in the 19th century, but still today, has extremes of wealth and poverty, extremes of creative, innovative thinking and writing, alongside an underworld that is, in British terms at least, second to none. So you have this extraordinary mix of polarized forces that are constantly moving and shaking about, and you know, that's Dostoevsky's world.
I mean, you've pointed to some of the ways there are similarities perhaps between Dostoevsky's context and the Glaswegian one, and listening to you here in Central Australia, a place of absolute extremes. That there's challenges in dragging Dostoevsky into our world as well, as you have said in many of your essays and in this book too, challenges to do with the misogyny of his time that is not altogether unfamiliar now, the religious nationalism, the imperial visions, particularly of contemporary Russia. How do you navigate that as someone who's been reading Dostoevsky for decades to kind of, you know, to see him quoted by Putin, by apologists for the war in Ukraine, things like that?
Yeah, it's people are uncomfortable. They don't fit into neat molds, and there's bits of Dostoevsky that I or other readers will warm to, and there's other bits that we don't. In terms of our contemporary issues that you just listed, for example, I think he's one of the earliest writers to really make a big theme out of violence against women and to expose some of the things that were going on in his society, and also the abuse, including the sexual abuse of children, which he wrote about with a frankness that you won't find in any Western European writers at the time. And I think what he's doing there is saying to society, look, this is going on. We all know it's going on, and no one dares speak about it. So I think he really was a consciousness raiser in that regard. You're right. He's certainly a hero in the pantheon of Russian nationalist thinking. He, as you say, he's been quoted by Putin, particularly with regard to his criticism of the West. And it's true that Dostoevsky was a very nationalistic Russian, a very strong critic of the West. And there's many things to be said either side of that. At the same time, that he did on one occasion, for example, say that in time to come, the Slavic nations would probably turn away from Russia and move towards the West. But, he said, the one thing Russia must not do in that situation is use its military might to force the other Slavic peoples back into the fold. So you can find different things in Dostoevsky, even on the subject of Russia. And of course, it's not a given that Dostoevsky would have accepted the present Russian regime as a legitimate successor to the Tsarist regime that he himself supported. There are some Russians today who call Putin a czar, a new czar, a Christian czar even. But Dostoevsky, we don't know what he might have thought. He might have seen Putin as the ex-KGB man, and in Putin's own words, there's no such thing as an ex-KGB officer. At the end of the book, the author is just putting together his notes from these conversations and writing them up when Russia invades Ukraine. And he wants Dostoevsky to come back and tell him what he thinks about it, but he doesn't. That we have to work that out for ourselves. And I think that the great writers of the past, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Dostoevsky, many others, that in some ways the human heart hasn't changed that much in these centuries. But of course, our political and social organization has changed a lot. And I think there are many problems about trying to use writers or philosophers, for that matter, from the past to try to solve our very practical contemporary political questions. I don't say they have nothing to say, but you can't just take something from a writer and immediately apply it to our present political situation. That's not what literature's about.
That resistance that I think comes through really clearly in these conversations, George, to telling the narrator or the reader or any of us, you know, what it all means now is really marked. I mean, the Dostoevsky that appears to this middle-aged bloke rarely gives a direct answer to his questions, even on the existence of God. There's a very funny interaction, I think, early in the book where the academic wants to know about faith. And Dostoevsky is just like, why are you asking me this? Ask God, which is a problem because the narrator's not sure that he even believes in such a thing. And yet he persists. He turns to the author, to the writings. And it made me wonder, do we read fiction partly, do you think, out of a sense of the absence of God in our time?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think we certainly have difficulties, even those who would say they believe, we certainly have difficulties in approaching God directly. We don't know what words to say. What are the true words? What are the honest words? And writers, or spiritual writers from the past as well, can help us to develop these. Though ultimately, I think it is very simple. At the end of the conversations, Dostoevsky reminds the narrator that when he was a prisoner in Siberia, where he served as a convict for 4 years alongside murderers, rapists, people who'd done the most terrible things, they were taken to church during Holy Week for the Easter services. They were taken from the camp to the church in chains, under guard. And as he tells the narrator, the rifles were loaded, and if anyone of them had tried to escape, they'd have been shot. But when they got to the church, there he was amongst these prisoners, and he remembered as a child when they went to church, a middle-class family, so they stood near the front, and as a child he was rather afraid of the dirty and dangerous-looking people at the back of the church, and now he was one of these very dirty and dangerous-looking people. And one woman even gave him a kopeck in alms. But that when the prisoners prayed, God save us, they really meant it. That when you're pushed to the real edge, you know what to say. That there's no room for doubt anymore.
Although not all of the characters who suffer I'm saying this to you, in Dostoevsky's novels, come to such clarity of vocabulary or belief, obviously.
I think that's one of the problems that many of these characters, many of us, have, is that we don't want to acknowledge our suffering. We don't want to be seen as weak or powerless. I think it's part of the ideology of our time, again, as it was part of the ideology of Dostoevsky's time, that we want to be our own legislators, if you like. A recent British Prime Minister famously said that we're rule makers, not rule takers. And I think that's something very deep in the psychology of our time. We don't want to be told what to do by anyone else. We want to set our own agenda. We don't want to acknowledge the points of uncertainty, of doubt, of weakness in our lives. And that's part of what makes it difficult for us, I think, to go directly to the point, either in the context of decisive human relationships or in the context of the God relationship.
Great literature as a fulcrum of belief and doubt. I'm talking with Professor George Patterson on Soul Search. He spent decades thinking about Dostoevsky and the religious aspects of existentialist thought. His latest book is Conversations with Dostoevsky on God, Russia, Literature and Life. Dostoevsky appears right throughout these conversations in all kinds of different ways. He turns up in the kitchen one night when the narrator's washing up during a dinner party with all his arts friends, which was very funny. And there's one moment where he's kind of changed. There's something in the conversation that prompts like a moment of transfiguration. And it made me wonder about the role of experience and mystical experience. What do you think that can bring to someone like the narrator, someone like a contemporary thoughtful reader who I guess is at least sitting with that big question of how do I make meaning in my life?
Yes, I think that's spot on, that, you know, one can talk with Dostoevsky for so long, for hours and hours and hours, and that can help to move us on from whatever situation we might be in. But then there is a point where, as it were, you have to take the leap for yourself. You mentioned Dostoevsky says at the beginning, why not ask God? That there's a point at which, you know, we stop talking to each other and have to talk to God. I mean, just as, you know, a couple of guys might be talking about a girl they want to go out with and says, you know, ask her. And the two guys can talk about it endlessly. But it all changes when, you know, he goes over and says, do you want to come out?
Mm.
It's not talking about someone, it's talking to someone, talking with someone, we hope.
Mm. How important was that, do you think, to Dostoevsky? Do you know how he prayed?
He doesn't actually say a lot about that directly. We know that Dostoevsky experienced some extremely painful things in his life. Quite apart from his imprisonment, he lost two children in infancy and early childhood. And we know that these cut him to the quick, and that he saw
what happened to them.
One was a little baby girl who died in infancy, in the way many children in the 19th century did. Yeah. And the Dostoevskys were living in Europe at the time in extreme poverty and a very unstable situation. The little boy was, I think, about 4 years old and developed epilepsy. So
hard
after the death of the little parent, boy, yeah. Dostoevsky went on a pilgrimage to this famous monastery to seek comfort from the spiritual leader, the starets or elder there. And although he doesn't write about this directly, we see something of that reflected in the character of the elder Zosima in The Brothers Karamazov. And his message, again and again, is the very simple one, is just to open your heart, just to ask, to speak your truth, I think, with God, and then see what happens. Because for all the big melodrama, the dramatic situations, at the heart of it, I think Dostoevsky's faith was a very simple one. The faith that we must love one another, and we must ask for the power to live in love. The Elder Zosima, asked to define hell, says hell is the state of not being able to love. And I think that's a pretty good definition, if we have to have one at all.
As you've said, George, Dostoevsky presents his readers with deeply confronting portraits of human behaviour at their most violent, the most abusive, and yet that I think that's a question we all feel, like how, given the catastrophes, large and small, of the world that we share, can you yet believe in love as not only a possibility but as the fundamental reality of all that is? And I think the narrator feels that question.
Yeah, I think that For Dostoevsky, ultimately, there's no alternative, or that the alternative is the war of all against all. And that was what he feared was coming to Russia and indeed to Europe in the future. One of the paradoxes is that he discovered this in prison, and he discovered it from some of the brutal and violent convicts with whom he was living, because he learned to see that for all the brutality of their lives, and of course many of them were men without any education, with terrible alcohol problems, many of them had been serfs, that is, in effect, slaves. They never enjoyed freedom or the luxury of self-development or having a therapist or anything like that. But that there was nevertheless a kindness and a gentleness in which they cared for one another. And he remembered from his own childhood how one of the peasants on his father's estate helped him when he was running away from a wolf, or from what he thought was a wolf. And this rough, burly man showed a kind of tenderness to him that he'd never experienced before, never experienced, you know, amongst his middle class friends and family. So there is, even under the most, let's say, repulsive exterior, that possibility of love lives on. And that's what many people in his time, I think, admired so much about his writings, that he showed people who hadn't been appearing in literature before then, poor people, uneducated people, losers, if you like, that all of these types nevertheless had rich possibilities of love, just as much so as the princes and the princesses and the aristocrats who tended to people previous fiction.
This is an impulse that he shares to some extent with Tolstoy.
I think that's right, only Tolstoy tends to be, I think, a little bit more sentimental about them, because much as he may have spent time working in the fields with the peasants, he didn't have to live day and night with them in the same way that Dostoevsky had. But yes, they both shared this sense that somehow the common people, if you like, kept something alive, something of our essential humanity, solidarity, if you like, alive in a way that the very individualized middle and upper classes didn't.
There's data now on how segregated our cities are becoming with just the stratification of our economic realities. It's true now, I think, that you're more likely to live next door to someone who's kind of like you or shares a class background with you than you were a couple of generations ago. And I guess given what you've said about the role that direct experience played in Dostoevsky's life in terms of his capacity to see all people as beings destined for love, or who must be loved, who are loved, whatever else might also be true.
And beings who have the possibility to love as well. I think there's no condescension there. It's not how can we, the educated and the people who've seen the world, how can we make these people better? It's how are we going to learn from them? But you're absolutely right in what you're saying about our stratification. I remember many years ago reading about this happening in America, and that seemed to be a very American thing at that time. I'm talking about the 70s or 80s, but it's happening more and more certainly in Britain too. I've spent a lot of my life in villages where it's less true, but even villages now are becoming particular kinds of villages, as it were, villages where people maybe have a second home, or holiday villages or commuter villages. So again, you're not getting the same social mix. And in a way, social media is the extreme version of this, where the algorithms work to connect you with people who have the same views as yourself, who think like you, who act like the same things as you. And this is a very worrying development, really, because it inevitably erodes our human solidarity. the realization, well, not just the intellectual realization, but the feeling, the sense that we are all of one flesh.
Which is what I wanted to ask you, like, what's your sense of our capacity, our desire even now to entertain an idea of one another and of the love that is owed between people, I think you could say, these days? Is this what we need fiction for? Is this why yeah. I don't know, there might be something lost if we all stopped reading Dostoevsky. I don't know.
I think when you say owed to people, that's a really accurate phrase for what Dostoevsky is about. The Elder Zosima's teaching is that we're all guilty of everything before everyone, and I most of all. But when he says guilt, I think he means indebted, that we owe our lives to one another. None of us couldn't have survived infancy if we hadn't been nurtured and cared for by our primary caregivers. We couldn't have acquired the knowledge we have, the skills we have, the capacities we have without literally hundreds, maybe thousands of people being involved in it. We all owe our lives to one another. And learning that is partly an intellectual thing. It's partly learning to recognize that this is the reality of our situation. And it's also an emotional thing to be able to open up to that. And as I was saying before, to accept that I'm not in charge of my own world. I'm only one actor amongst many in this human drama, and that I have to be able to receive as well as to give. Dostoevsky himself at one point, I think, brought this to a head in saying the contemporary attitude is, I'm as good as the next man, but leaving out the corollary of that, which is the next man's as good as me.
Mm.
And we have to have both those things.
There wouldn't be many people who've read Dostoevsky as attentively as you over a long, long time. And I wonder how you would sum up what Dostoevsky has meant to you as you, like all of us, sit with those questions of making meaning in your life, becoming more open to a love of other humans. I mean, could you, I'm not really asking you to quantify it, but how would you begin to describe what reading Dostoevsky has meant in your own life and sense of what this is all about?
I first started reading Dostoevsky in my 20s at a time when I was working in a psychiatric hospital.
Really?
And, yeah, and I think that the world he described, particularly Crime and Punishment, the Idiot, the Petersburg novels, seemed to reveal people who were like the people I was encountering at that time. People, if you like, who are on the edge, not sometimes economically, but also mentally, people who are having to struggle to survive, to get through the day. And Dostoevsky taught me, or he helped me to see more clearly, that no matter how deteriorated the quality of a person's life is, that person is still reachable. And there were some amazing experiences at that time, which I think were quite Dostoevskian for me. So, for example, we had one patient called Annie, and she couldn't talk at all. She's wheelchair-bound, she couldn't talk, but she had the sweetest and most loving face, and she would hold your hand and stroke you, and she gave an extraordinary amount. And I think Dostoevsky would have understood someone like that in a way that many other writers perhaps wouldn't. He had antennae, if you like, for that spark of beauty and love in what didn't really look very beautiful at all. And I would say that he is also a writer who can reach the parts that other writers can't. If I can tell you a slightly funny story, that I was once on a train from Glasgow back to Oxford. And when the train got to Carlisle in the north of England, a whole lot of drunken football supporters got on. They were actually Celtic supporters, one of the two big Glasgow teams, and they'd been thrown off the previous train because they were so drunken. And I was sitting there reading a book of philosophy in German, very quietly to myself, in the quiet zone where you're not meant to speak above a whisper. But, you know, they were shouting away for half an hour, and I won't repeat what the only word I could understand was. After about half an hour, the young guy next to me turned to me and said, "Hope we're not interrupting your reading." I said, no, that's fine. And then he said, "What are you reading?" And he started interrogating me about my reading. And I said I did a lot of work in 19th century thought. And he said, "Oh, my pal, he read a 19th century book." So he stood up and he shouted down to the other end of the carriage, "Jimmy, what's that 19th century book you read?" And Jimmy stood up and shouted, "Dostoevsky." So, you know, I mean, in a way that illustrates it. I mean, these are a bunch of guys you wouldn't have singled out as Dostoevsky readers, but there you go. Prejudices fly to the winds. And
Well, yes, that is a surprising encounter, but I guess, what do you think the most surprising question is that Dostoevsky poses to his readers today? I mean, we expect him to talk about God and nihilism and perhaps even love, but what do you think a fresh reader would find most startling of his concerns?
Well, people would expect him to say something about God if they've read the blurbs on the backs of the books, but I think they'd still be surprised at the way he goes about it and amazed at some of the extraordinary scandal scenes he builds up. One of his great literary achievements, I think, is the presentation of these group scenes where there's some terrible quarrel going on, which may or may not be violent, but it's bitter words are exchanged. Absurd things happen in the middle of it. It's almost utterly chaotic. And, you know, when I was first reading these, it all said, "Oh, that's all very Russian," because we know that, you know, Russians are very extreme and very voluble. And then I kind of sat back and thought, actually, this is quite like some of our family gatherings. You know, if you change the rhetoric, you change the style, these are the sort of interactions that we have. But it is astonishing the way he is, I think, able to present this interaction of personalities and voices and to mingle the tragic, the comic, the absurd in one and the same scene.
I mean, in a way, yes, an intensification of real life, you could say.
Exactly.
George Patterson is a former professor of divinity at Oxford and Glasgow universities and a leading scholar of Russian religious thought. His book is Conversations with Dostoevsky on God, Russia, Literature and Life. It's a great read, and if you'd like to follow it up, you'll find the links on the Soul Search website. On ABC Radio National this summer, we're revisiting our favourite episodes from the last year. And if you've enjoyed this one as much as I have, the good news is that there's a whole series just waiting for your ears. It's called Big Questions in Books, and it's a really great listen. There's an episode on children's literature and ideas of enchantment in Lewis, Tolkien and Rowling. There's one on classical Chinese poetry and what it has to say about reality and ecology. There's one on the feminist afterlives of the Indian epics, one on Jane Austen and the complications of friendship. There's even one on what American cosmic horror has to do with negative theology. Intrigued? We'll find all these episodes by searching the ABC Listen app or heading to the Soul Search website. The Big Questions in Books series might be just the thing for your summer holiday listen. For now, thanks for your company, and thanks to producers Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'll catch you for Soul Search again by podcast on Radio Australia and ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.